Hello everyone. What you're about to hear is the first half of a two-part episode focusing on the collieries of the Northeast and the railways that served them. We're going to be talking about the landscape, the technology, and the people who worked in this industry. The second part of the episode will focus on a few of the private railways themselves, going into more detail about their individual setups and operation. We hope you enjoy it. Hello and welcome back to Railway Mania. Today we're going to be talking about the stuff that began it all, the so-called Black Diamonds. Coal, specifically the coal railways of Northeast England. My guest today is Nick Richardson, a native of the Northeast.
That'll be right, yes.
And he's given many talks on the subject. Thanks very much for joining us today, Nick.
Hi, good evening. It's nice to talk to you.
So you grew up in the Northeast. You're now living down in the Southwest near me, in the sunny Southwest.
Well, it's not that sunny at the moment, is it? No. Yes, I did. I grew up close to South Shields in a village called East Bolden at a time when there was still a heavy industry. Lots of coal being moved, ships being built, constant ironworks were open. And as a young lad, up to about the age of 12 or 13, it was all industry, all heavy industry, birthplace of the railways. And everywhere you looked, there were really interesting things for somebody to sort of go, what's that about? And, oh, look at that ship. I mean, for example, my dad once took us to Austin Pickersgill's yard on the Weir because he knew a guy who was in refit, and we went on board what seemed like a huge ship. Probably wasn't that big, but when you're 11 or 12, it was massive. And just the journey from the railway station at home to Newcastle was full of interesting things to look at. Coke works and cranes being tested. So it was from my perspective, really interesting.
So I always liked to ask people about where their interest in railways and technology came from. And was that it for you, was growing up around it?
I guess so. And my dad's got a long-standing interest in railways. And it must have rubbed off on me. My dad became a volunteer at several of the preservation societies, and particularly at Bowes in the late 70s, 1980s, and then moved on and did other things, went to North Tyneside Steam Railway. And I got bored of colliery railways and went across to the Lakeside and Haverthwaite, which had proper trains. But I don't know where it came from. I think it might just be as a young child watching trains go by my bedroom window. When the coal trains came through, and we're talking about Class 37s and 24-ton hoppers, the plates on the wall rattled. And up until, we didn't have double glazing for a long time, and sash windows would rattle as the train went past.
Oh, yeah. We used to have sash windows. I used to live next to the Greyweston main line. We had sash windows. And just the rumble you get of anything going past, like the whole house would shake anyway. But,
well, it was even better because where the station was, the Northeastern Railway had put a platform extension that was made of wood, and you could get underneath it. And of course, you did all the things you shouldn't do, like put pennies on the track and put your head out as the trains were thundering across until we got caught by the signalman who knew me mum. And it was not pretty that night.
No. I mean, in your best interests, though, I think.
Yeah.
If you were to continue that kind of behaviour, it might not have led to the a long life.
No, being inches away from a train thundering past.
Thrilling, though.
Oh, yeah. And I've got no fear of big machinery, and that's kind of pervaded through. I went to sea as well as other things, and the bigger the better as far as I'm concerned. I like big bits of equipment. I'm not afraid of it. I respect it, and you've got to be careful with it, and you've got to know what you're doing, and don't expect to be able to operate something without being properly trained. But yeah, the bigger the better, the noisier the better. Yeah.
Well, I mean, you can't really get much noisier and bigger than ships and trains.
No, not really.
And the industry that you grew up on. So tell me a bit about the landscape that you were growing up in. This was, like you say, the birthplace of the railways. But was it an area in decline when you were growing up?
Yes, it was. But it wasn't apparent until I was about 13 or 14. So the first 10 years of my life, the industry wasn't really changing that much. But then all of a sudden, we've got things like the miners' strike. We've got the decline of the shipbuilding industry. I mean, I think Austin Pickersgill were told to close. They were a nationalised industry in the 1980s because there was too much shipbuilding capacity in Europe. And this is a company who had pioneered the ships that replaced the Liberty ships from Second World War. I think they were called SD-14. So they had this modular concept that they'd gone and done. And I do remember a guy who, I was probably at a birthday party or something like that, and he said, we've got people from Korea in the yard being taught how to build ships. It's not going to end well for the British shipbuilding industry. And if you think about it, Hyundai, Daewoo, and some of the bigger Korean yards are building huge ships. I think it all kind of came to a fairly abrupt halt from about 1984 onwards. I guess landmark events, the close of the Consett Steelworks, miners' strike, as we've discussed, which has got had significant effects on industry, some of the nationalised industries, and the effect of Europe, and the decline in the use of coal as an energy source. A lot of the coal that was being cut was going to this, what was the Central Electricity Generating Board for power stations. People don't realise until the 1970s, Battersea Power Station in London was burning 1 million tonnes a year. And lots of the industries that needed coal didn't need it anymore. So it was in decline. But it was not something that I noticed necessarily in our household. Only that my dad was a draftsman. He worked for NEI Railroads and then went off to a smaller company and then back into NEI, made redundant 2 or 3 times. But because my mother was a professional, a nurse, we were insulated a bit from it. But I think there were people that really struggled. And the other thing that I've sort of reflected on is it took about 10 years. So there was like clear water between the decline of the coal industry or the closure of some of the collieries for things to start to regenerate. Because although industry was in decline, the NCB had this idea of they would close a colliery and then clear the site, but nothing came behind it. So you've got hundreds, maybe thousands of men with no job looking at the place they once worked.
No transition of labour, no, really, transition, no retraining.
No, nothing.
Sort of no aftercare.
No, not in the same way. I mean, you know, my father ended up as a hospital porter in South Shields. And for the last 5 years of his working life, because he took early retirement, and all the men that worked in that area of the hospital were either fitters, platers, welders. They all had trades. In fact, it was said there wasn't a job you couldn't have done out of the porter's lodge. And they all spoke porterese. Yeah, it is a bit strange how things move on. And the landscape that you see today is very, very different to the landscape that was there. It was very grimy, very black, very industrial.
Yeah.
You know, you could walk out the front door and smell the coke works in the air, and that was 3 or 4 miles away. And certainly when you went past it on the train, you could smell them. And they were pretty horrible. You know, it was sulphurous, horrible stuff. You could see the glow at night when they were taking the coke out of the ovens.
Well, something that, so I guess you could call it a dramatic landscape. Great for modelling, great subjects to model. Great to feature in films, that kind of stuff, but
well, the probably not Carter effect, maybe.
Well, yeah, not very nice to live amongst, I'd say. Just the filth.
Yeah, I think people were pragmatic. It was part of the landscape. And I don't think it was as filthy as you quite think. Certainly inside people's homes weren't. And, you know, miners were always well turned out because they were relatively well paid.
That's the thing about the pragmatism, is it's your living.
Yeah.
I remember an ex-miner being interviewed on the TV, and he was saying, but this is how you could be working class and afford a house.
Yeah.
You go underground.
Yeah, yeah. And if you go wind it back, miners had houses, they had, or the, you know, if they were working in a colliery that had its own housing stock, you got coal, you sometimes got an allotment.
Yeah, imagine not having to pay your heating bill.
Yeah. Have you ever been to the Open Air Museum at Beamish?
I really want to. It's on my to-do list.
Brilliant. But there is a set of miners' cottages in the miners' village set up for, and there's one, it's a retired miner, if I get this right, somebody else whose father's died, but the two of the guys are still working in the pit, another one with, like, father and 3 sons, and they're relatively prosperous. They're not going hungry because it's hard work. I think the other thing about this as well is that the knock-on effect, the social economic effect, was in somewhere like Sunderland, South Shields, Newcastle. You've got a coal industry that fuels heavy engineering and also things like shipbuilding. So there's lots and lots of parallel technological development going on. So by the time I get to it, we're at the tail end of what had been lots and lots of technological innovation and coal powered the Industrial Revolution, didn't it? And I find it really strange that today we're here with an energy crisis and it's costing an awful lot of money to generate electricity, yet even in the 1980s, British Coal were telling people, or the NCB, whatever the transition was, there are 400 years of coal under the North East. So maybe in our lifetime, we'll see them cutting coal again to be burnt as long as it can be done cleanly.
Exactly.
And that's the issue, isn't
it? It's an interesting thing. There was an ad for NCB that I saw recently, and their slogan was, because people will always need coal. And
yeah.
It's like, well, that turned out not to be true for the NCB.
Yeah.
What a statement to make.
I think there's a time shift documentary on BBC Four called When Coal Was King or something like that. And it talks about the NCB film unit going from being sort of Mr. Chumley Warner and, oh, this is marvellous, to really upbeat, the kind of thing you've just said. You know, coal will lead the way because I don't know what percentage of output was being used to generate electricity, but a lot at that time.
Mm.
So who knows, what goes around comes around, but
yeah.
It won't be a popular choice the way things are going to say we're going to burn coal again. It would have to be something clever. But
yeah,
who knows?
Well, maybe with the development of carbon capture systems or things like that.
Yeah, who knows?
Well, let's rewind a bit then. You say this is the birthplace of the railways, which we all know, but what are some landmark dates around the development of the coal industry in the Northeast?
I guess you're probably talking about the introduction of steam technology into the coal fields, because originally coal was found close to the surface of the river. You didn't have to go very deep for it. In fact, there were coal bunkers in Hadrian's Wall, apparently. Coal was a fuel that was going down to London, and it was a fuel of the rich. Samuel Pepys talks about not getting coal because of wars that were going on in against the Spanish and the Dutch, and obviously against the French, because we're always a war against the French. And when you get the development of the beam engine, the sort of the Cornish engine, if you like, you can dig deeper mines. And why can you dig deeper mines? Because you can keep the water out of them. And so parallel to that technology, you've got the laying down of plateways or wagonways, which traditionally were either wooden or later iron rails. I do remember reading or seeing as a kid they'd done some excavation somewhere and found original wagonways made out of
almost
like...
It's like excavating Roman ruins.
Yeah. It's just amazing stuff.
And like, to think that wood has lasted so long in the soil there.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
Yeah, it's really, well, I guess it was probably backfilled with all sorts of shale and nonsense and whatever
the
over the top.
Toxic chemicals.
Yeah.
Observing it. So then we have the development of iron rails.
Yeah, and you sort of see the use of steam locomotives. Hetton Colliery was one, George Stephenson, Wylam, about the 1820s, one or two things really changed the coal industry. One was the introduction of steamships, because up until about the 1850s, coal was being shipped in keels. It was being loaded from cauldron wagons, which are the typical northeastern black wagons that would carry...
So you've got the sort of angled sides.
Yeah, angled sides,
like the classic hopper shape.
Yeah, like the Acura scale models,
right,
that have
yeah.
been produced, sometimes called cauldrons, sometimes called black wagons. Anything between 1.5 and 4 tons, dependent on where they were running, how old they were. Very close to the river, one horse pulling one wagon, being dropped into a keel. A keel had about 4 men. 20 tons taken to a sailing ship that was going to take it out.
So is the keel acting like a lighter?
Yeah. Okay. No, it's a barge.
Okay.
It's like you've heard the song The Keel Row.
Right.
Yeah, that's where that's from. I'll row the keel row, the ship that my lad's in.
Nice.
Yeah, my auntie used to sing that to us when we were little. It's a Geordie song. And so it's like parallel folklore, isn't it?
Are you going to lead us out with that song, Nick?
I'm not. If you want to put some suitable music over the top, feel free.
I'll have a look.
But it is it's just one of the Household Cavalry's quick marches as well, isn't it?
Probably, yeah. My friend is in the cavalry. I should probably go and ask
You should him. Ask, yeah. And there was a very long tradition of sailing brigs and sailing barks, dependent on the shape and size of the ship. But they'd move around between 400 and 700 tons. And they were really well-built ships. Both HMS Bounty and HMS Endeavour had been previously laid down as sailing colliers.
Right.
Yeah. So they were well-built ships, because in order to get from the North Sea, from Tyneside down to the Thames, which is where it was going, they needed to be really seaworthy because they have to go against the wind going north.
Right.
And it was taking around about 30 days for a sailing ship to get from the Tyne to the Thames and back. In the 1850s, John Bowes and partners of the Bowes Railway fame, related to the Queen Mother, the Bowes Lyon family, had a steam collier built that cut that trip down to about a week.
That's amazing. So a quarter of the time?
A quarter of the time, dependent on wind and weather, do about 9 knots, and it had some other interesting things as well. It didn't need to bring ballast back. So a sailing ship had to be ballasted, and they would take on sand as ballast, and that fed the glass industry on the Tyne and the Weir.
Right.
And it also sort of...
Well, it's that classic haulier thing. You want a backload,
don't you? Exactly. You want a backload. But these had water-ballasted tanks, so they didn't have to backload. The issue then was the keel kind of died away, but these were bigger ships that would take bigger loads. So you see the introduction of the Tyne Improvement Commission, where they dredged the river, they changed the bridges. There's a swing bridge put in Newcastle that allows, ostensibly, warships to come from the works up the river, down and through, but you've still got big staves at places like Dunstan that can be loaded. And colliers, they need tugs, but they're not really worried about wind or tide in the same way a sailing ship is. And you sort of see in the 1860s the development of the town, and the demand for coal went through the roof because it was being used to raise steam for the new steam technology, and certain kinds of industries demanded certain kinds of coal.
So coal ends up supporting its own customers in that way.
Yeah.
And you have this almost black hole void of London just sucking in every resource from around it. So you have the North Sea colliers plying the trade up and down, and just back and forth and back
and forth. Coming from South Wales as well. Some of the coal was going across to the continent, and you see loads of coal going up to into the Low Countries, and the bringing back timber into the Tyne for pit props. Pine from and the Baltic Quay is called the Baltic Quay because that's where the ships in the Baltic came into.
It's interesting what you say about staves, because for the uninitiated it might be worth just talking about what that piece of technology is.
So a stave is effectively a large wooden structure that's built out into the river that allows you to unload by gravity.
So it looks like a trestle bridge.
Yeah, like an American trestle bridge, really. The topography of the Tyne and the Weir in many places, the banks are quite steep, and many of the staves were quite far upriver. And with bigger ships, they had to move a bit closer to the river mouth. So in Sunderland, in particular, they were really close to the entrance to the Weir. You can see from where the Wearmouth, Lambton, Hetton staves were, entrance to the North Sea, so a very short transit. But they were generally built out of timber. And again, it was imported, and I read somewhere that, you know, they're talking about 13-inch square timber bolts being brought in to build the structures. And there are sort of two parts to it. There's like a spout, which is like a chute. And so you see the development of the classic northeastern bottom-doored hopper wagon that allows you to unload by gravity.
Well, that must have been on its own such a huge labour-saving device.
Well, yeah.
If you think about manhandling wagons and wagons into a ship's hold, or using derricks or anything else like that, if you can just drop it straight in.
Yeah, and it's interesting because the South Dock in Sunderland, built in the 1850s by George Hudson, the Railway King, as a direct result of other coal owners setting up their own shipping facilities, you see these sort of big derrick affairs where you take a wagon and it would swing out and down, and the whole wagon would discharge its cargo into the hold. That's for several reasons. One, some coal is more valuable in larger lumps, and the less distance it has to fall, the less breakage there is. And there's a really fantastic book, and maybe you put a link into it, and it's called From Conveyor to Stave, A History of Coal Moving Machinery. It is properly, it made me want to read it. But what is interesting is you look at the way the South Wales coal was moved, and you see these devices to try and stop the coal being broken. South Wales steam coal is very friable, meaning it's soft.
And so that's basically what the Great Western designed their loco policy around.
Yeah. And why Great Western coaling stages don't have much in the way of mechanical handling.
And very short drops.
Yeah, they are.
But I think a lot of people may think that coal is just coal wherever you go. But, I mean, I remember someone saying it wasn't unusual back in the day to see fully loaded coal trains heading in opposite directions carrying two different types of coal.
I remember that, because if you had coal that needed to go to the coke works and it was coming from a colliery, let's say in County Durham, it was going, let's say, north. Or if coal was going to a power station south, it was going south because it was steam raising coal. Mm. And what is interesting is the way in which the Admiralty, for example, wanted South Wales coal.
Right.
For lots of reasons. It was good at raising steam, but importantly, it had very low smoke output. So if you're a ship at sea, you don't want to give away your position.
Yeah.
But there is a discussion in Hansard from the 1870s about MPs talking about mixing northern smoky coals with South Wales coals, because the northern coals kept steam perfectly. The South Wales coals burnt really hot, but for us in a different way, and trying to get the right mix for both tactics, keeping steam, and not being seen. And the other thing with coal is it degrades over time. And apparently South Wales coal, and I only learned this the other day because I was doing a bit of research, doesn't like to be out in the sun. It goes dusty and goes off. Coal goes off if you don't use it.
Isn't that mad that you think a rock can go off?
Yeah, it loses its volatility. If you want a bit more chapter and verse, there is a YouTube clip where Chris Price from the North Yorkshire Motor Railway is with the Talith Lane, and they're talking about the Heritage Railway coal crisis, fuzzy fan and all that kind of stuff.
It's a great video.
Yeah.
I think any steam enthusiast should watch that and then understand more about what it means about where to get coal and what coal does and how it behaves.
Yeah. In the northeast, you had pits producing steam coal, house coal, coking coal, gas coal. And why is that important? Because as we move from the 1860s, 70s, 80s, development of cities, if you look at London, coal companies were using coal to make gas because London was gas lit. Now, it wasn't just by sea. The railway companies obviously moved a lot of it as well. But if you are the Wandsworth Gas and whatever Gas Supply Company Limited, and you've got a great big swathe of London to keep lit, you need fuel all the way through. All this technological innovation that was the urban metropolis.
Mm. Well, I'm guessing, and I mean, the atomic age didn't start until, you know, post-war at the very start. And it was a long time until nuclear power generation really came online.
Yeah, yeah.
So alternative power to coal, it was the main source of power. And before gas came online, really, which was the main success to coal and power generation in the UK.
And as you go further on, and you see Marsden Rail and those kind of companies have got lots of, you know, videos. And I've seen pictures of power station coal being loaded, and it's really small because it's going to be crushed and then put through like a fluid furnace.
There's a great... there's a small series of videos about Rugeley Power Station when that was still in operation, and they go into the coal that they need for that and how much they need and how much they go through, and it is tiny. It's like dust
almost,
that they're putting into it.
But if you've got an open fire or a log burner or whatever, or even on a steam locomotive, if you've got dust and you throw it at the fire, it just ignites, doesn't it? It goes woof. So you can see why, you know, this people were very concerned about not having too much dust and keeping it wet back and whatever. But yeah, and loading it is less, you're less bothered if you've got small coal, it's going to be fine anyway, going down long spouts and drops. But if you look at the big stays that were built by the Northeastern Railway, in order to sort of compensate for tide, the spouts were at two or three different levels so that the coal only fell a certain amount.
There's something that cuts through all of this, and it is efficiency, the need to get coal moving all the time. So you can't wait for the right tide, you can't wait for the right conditions. Like you say, they switch to screw propellers instead of sail power. It just needs to get there as fast as possible.
Yeah, the coal moved whatever the weather, you know, and if it's cold, people want to keep warm. Mm-hmm. And I think fundamentally it was driven by the coal owners and the coal company's desire to make money.
Mm-hmm.
Because although they paid their miners and the men that worked their railways and everything else reasonably well, it was the likes of Lord Londonderry, Lord Lambton and others that made the money.
Well, I think it won't be worth going into this, but so who were the coal owners? Because I think a lot of people may have grown up with National Coal Board being a nationalised industry, but it was never like that to begin with.
No, effectively, if you had coal on your land, you then had the ability to dig down to get it. So in the northeast, you've got the likes of Lambton in County Durham, Lord Londonderry in around Seaham. Further inland, the so-called Grand Allies around about the John Bowes and Partners in Springwell. And John Bowes is related to the Bowes Lyon family of the Queen Mother fame. And other people, basically the landowners, the gentry of the time.
So you could own a lot of land for, your family could own it for centuries, and then you find out you're sitting on gold.
Yeah.
The black diamond.
Yeah, it's like finding oil in your back garden, isn't it, really? Yeah. And I think we've got to remember as well that labour was cheap and plentiful.
This is pre-First World War.
Yeah.
Pre-the general strike.
Yeah.
Everything else like that.
Yeah, yeah. And in terms of peak production, the most coal was cut in 1913 in the northeast. My figures tell me 56 million tonnes in the northeast in 1913.
It's so hard to picture numbers like that.
Well, the total coal output of the UK around about that time was about 287 million tonnes.
Whoa. And that's everywhere in the UK.
Yeah.
So what does he say? 58 million coming out of the northeast.
Yeah. About 15 million tonnes out of Northumberland.
And that's the peak just before the First World War.
Yeah. Mm. And about 42 million tonnes out of County Durham. It was called the Great North Coalfield of all types. And if you look at the amount of coal that the railway companies moved then, the Northeastern Railway tops the chart, around 44 million tonnes. The Great Western...
I'd like to point out this is pre-grouping, before the JDR absorbed the Taffrail and...
Well, even before that was the case, the Great Western moved about 22 and the Taffrail about 16.
Wow.
So the Northeastern was... But actually, the Northeastern Railway was one of the only railways that consistently made money, and they made money because they moved
freight. Or didn't they end up being the senior partner in London Northeastern Railway?
Yeah, which didn't make money, did it? No.
Famously, yeah.
No. And interestingly, the Caledonian, 13 million tonnes. Why? Because we've got a coal-fired naval fleet in the north.
So that's Scarpa Flow, that area.
Yeah. And during the First World War, when they couldn't move coal by sea, you hear these Jellicoe specials that will run moving coal from the south to the north. And again...
So these are almost express trains of coal heading up there.
But I've got one picture somewhere that I've used in another presentation that I've done about railways and war. And it's a piano-fronted London Northwestern locomotive, about one of the only images I could find of coal being moved for the Admiralty.
Mm-hmm.
The Admiralty wanted, as we said, Welsh coal, but they would settle for other stuff because most of His Majesty's ships, would have been coal-fired reciprocating engines. Mm-hmm. Turret turbines and oil burners were state-of-the-art technology.
Mm. Well, any pre-dreadnought, I think, wouldn't have been fired on oil. It would have been coal-fired.
No, it probably would have been. It's even saying here that 1913, a little under a million tonnes of coal were burnt by the Northeastern Railway alone.
And if you think about that, a lot of that is just moving the coal. The act of actually transporting the coal itself is, that's a million tonnes by one railway company.
And 20% of all the coal in the UK in 1913 came from the northeast, and by 1948 it was about 25%.
Good grief. So we're talking about landmark dates then. So you're looking at 1870s, the development of the cities and the industry, and then the peak in 1913. Then what happens?
Well, First World War, I think, is probably what happens. Mm-hmm. And we go into the Great Depression, and industry's depressed, and people start to look to other ways of keeping warm. And
well, this ties into your point about labour as well.
Yeah, and labour's
the fact that labour then became a valuable commodity.
Yeah,
people started to recognise their own worth.
Yes,
and talking about the coal owners as well, the backlash against the coal owners that you saw in the interwar period, and especially post-war, post-Second World War, and the formation of the NCB, when they saw it as profiteering, almost.
I haven't done a huge amount of work on this particular subject, but I think there was a loss of European markets for British coal. And when the British are not able to move coal safely abroad, other people start mining coal and exporting
it as well. Or they switch energy sources. I think a similar thing happened with Welsh Slate. There was a huge strike and, everyone just looked elsewhere. And it never recovered.
Sounds about right, yeah. Mm. And if you think about it, the best coal was needed for ships because you want high quality coal if you're going to move a ship across large distances. So we're still seeing coal being shipped all over the world to support the shipping industry. But at the same time, I suppose you've got the development of other coal fields in other countries, Australia, America.
And still huge coal producers today.
Oh, they are, yeah. The Americans are effectively a coal-based economy, aren't they? They're maybe 30 or 40 years behind where we are with that, I guess. And I suppose the Americans start to become the dominant industrial power. You know, you've got the start of the use of oil, haven't you? You've got the development of Anglo-Persian oil in the Gulf.
And I think that this is one of the things that was attributed to Churchill during his time in the Admiralty, was he was one of the main people pushing for the conversion to oil burners for the fleet.
Yeah, it sounds about right, yeah. I wouldn't disagree with that.
And you should say that if they're a major customer of the coal industry, and then, you know, military power, well, military technology tends to lead civilian technology. So then you might see civilian ships moving over to oil burning later on too.
Yeah, but what's interesting about that is when you look at the Liberty ships that were built in the Second World War, they didn't put complicated technology in them. They were single screw, reciprocating, engined ships, because most of the crews were coming from the Merchant Navy that were still using that kind of technology. And some were oil burners. If you look at the Victory Inshore craft, you know, like the Vital Spark type.
Oh, yes, the puffers.
Yeah, the
yes.
Clyde puffers.
Yes.
They're coal-fired.
Mm-hmm.
The Victory ships aren't. They're oil-fired. But there's still lots of smaller companies plying their trade with oil, with coal-fired ships. But I think coal was still, you know, massive domestic market. Obviously, it powered the railways, power generation in fixed installations, like we've spoken about it before, Battersea, I guess, and other parts. And there's also coal gas. Mm-hmm. Most places had their own gas works, didn't they?
Mm-hmm. And yet for lighting.
Yeah.
Cooking.
Yeah.
All sorts. The next sort of phase that we're looking at, you're talking about the Great Depression leading to the 30s. And in terms of landmark dates, what does it look like for the coal industry from that point onwards?
Well, there's the obviously nationalisation of the industry following the Second World War. We've got, you know, Homes Fit for Heroes and the welfare state and all that kind of thing, based on the issues you've been talking about, like worth of labour and another World War. But at the same time, we're an empire in decline. But I think there's a, when you sort of see the literature and look at the films, there's like the National Coal Board film unit that was set up, there is a real feeling of optimism, isn't there? And the big drive for export, and you see it in things like all the steel was being exported, so the stuff that we were getting wasn't as good quality, so you get further down the line, things don't last as long. Yeah, you can see that. But I don't know that much actually changed for the men that were working these systems and working underground, other than somebody nailed up a sign that said, this is now belongs to the people, National Coal Board.
Meet the new boss.
Pretty much, same as the old boss, yeah.
Let's talk for a minute then about the people that worked here. You grew up in a coal mining community.
I did.
And what did you see of that?
I had friends whose fathers were miners. I went to school with a few people whose fathers were miners, and you could see that they were very proud men. They worked very hard. I remember there was a table in our infant school of, you know, like show and tell, and somebody's dad was a doctor and he brought the bag in with the stethoscope. Somebody's dad was a miner and they brought in this helmet and a miner's lamp and respirators, and you thought, whoa, where does this guy work? And a big pair of boots, and you're looking at it like that over the top. The guys I met when sort of the industry had declined and they were preserving what was left, but they were really proud men and they worked really hard, and I got a feeling of sort of comradeship. It sounds a bit trite, but they looked after one another. There's a Geordie phrase called a mara. Now, it's not a big vegetable. I don't know if you've heard this before. A mara is somebody you work with.
A mara. Is that what you'd refer to them as, like a mate? Like a mate, right. Okay.
But a mate that you work with in a difficult position.
Someone you can rely on.
Yeah, and there is a dialect called Pitmatic.
Mm-hmm.
And the mara is a Pitmatic word. In by, meaning inside, in the pit, is Pitmatic. I read mara, safe in by, that sort of thing. And I've seen and heard guys from Northumberland I just can't understand, because they're talking in an entirely different dialect.
Well, it's almost a different language.
Yeah, I mean, a raggy cunch, meaning a bit of rock in the road.
If you'd asked me to tell you what that was, I wouldn't have been able to guess.
A raggy conch.
Oh, I did not know.
Or a netty, which is a toilet. Oh, there's all sorts of really good ones.
So there's this huge sense of community amongst them.
Yeah, I think so. And I think
and they're all in it together, I guess. Yeah, when you're looking at it then, is this pre or post miners' strike?
Both.
Right, so during too.
Yeah, and during. And in fact, you know, the thing I remember having reflected on it, home economics, nobody likes home economics, but we've got to do it. In a school that is literally up the road from a colliery village that are 6 months into a strike, and they're being asked to bring ingredients in. Somebody is told by the teacher, because they mess about, to throw that in the bin. They do so. Next day, there's a letter, sort of fairly unhappy, from the parent of that child, because that was their dinner.
Wow.
My mum's not happy, yeah, because you made me throw away my dinner.
Serious hardship.
Oh, yeah. And I think some people, if you had a job working in local government or the NHS, whatever, you may have been insulated from it. But, you know, it did divide communities, and when you've got where the pit is the main employer in that part of the world, and it goes all that they're all on strike, it's pretty difficult. Have you ever seen the movie Pride?
Yeah.
That's kind of it, I suppose.
Yeah.
That feels quite like it.
Yeah.
My dad was a draftsman, and he served his time in heavy engineering, and there was this feeling of looking after the lads, and you had to make sure you looked out for one another. Because it was dangerous
for
work. Yamara, yeah. Mara's a pit word, but yeah, your mate, maybe. Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
I don't want to get that wrong.
Yeah. Well, there's some fantastic words. When my wife first went up north, she thought she'd gone to the moon. She's from Plymouth.
I struggled enough with Bristolian, I don't know. What was the general feeling in the air about the coal industry at that time? Did they feel like it was the end?
I think... You asked me to think about these questions before we sort of met, and I think now, thinking about it, it was sadness more than anything else. It was the
loss.
Loss. If you think that South Shields, as I remember it, the Crown Winder was a landmark in the town, big, tall, concrete building. Everybody knew what it was. It was Westall Colliery.
Mm.
That goes, and so all your heritage goes with it. You pull everything down, it disappears, and you've still got the men who spent all their lives there. And of course, if you're in your 50s and you lose your livelihood and you've still got a wife and children and a mortgage and everything else, it is difficult.
Mm.
And I think it took the whole region really a long time to reset after the decline of heavy industry. And part of me thinks in 50 years' time, when all the papers and whatever are available, there'll be a different take again, you know. Margaret Thatcher was not a popular person in the North East.
No. I imagine not in South Wales either.
No. Now, the issue, of course, is she was trying to do what she thought was the right thing for the country at the time. Mm. And we've seen papers where, you know, she says on the TV, this is not a political strike, yet we know the cabinet were talking about it.
Mm.
And I wonder if we'll see a bit more of that as things unravel and cabinet papers become...
Well, we may see revisionist history on the topic.
Yeah, absolutely. That's the exact way to look at it. And I think everybody looks at the past with rose-tinted glasses.
Certainly tempting.
Yeah.
I mean, I think for a lot of people it's because they were younger and they're a bit more carefree then. You know.
Well, I mean, you know...
I was happy then because I was ignorant.
Because I didn't care.
Yeah. I went under train platforms and stuck my head out and that kind of thing.
Yeah, and, you know, growing up close to South Shields... I knew that the collieries were there, but...
Well, this is what I wanted to ask you. Were you ever tempted to go down the mines?
Was I ever tempted? I think when I was younger, I probably wanted to be a mining engineer until maybe about 14 or 15, a guy who had been a pit fitter all his life said, there's no future, don't even think about it.
Mm.
You might want to be a fitter and turner, but they'll... You'll serve your time and they'll pay you off when you're 21 and you've got a trade and no job. What are you going to do?
Mm.
He said, go to university or do what you want to do, chase girls or whatever he thought was appropriate at the time. But no, there's no future in it.
Were there a lot of people in your position? Because obviously you went to sea and left for years after that. So were there many people who followed your footsteps?
Lots of people left the Northeast. There are five of guys in a cohort that we still talk to one another. And out of those five lads, one went offshore and spends his time between sort of Weardale, Brazil, and Portugal, because he's got a Brazilian family, because he worked in the oil industry and he's been all over the world.
Right.
Another guy joined the Royal Air Force. We don't like to talk about that.
No, no, of course
not. No, don't like to talk about that. But he now lives in the north of Scotland and looks after helicopters. Another guy went into the music business and lives in London. Only one still is in the village that we grew up in.
Wow.
My brother went back to the northeast, but he's a doctor. But he trained in Glasgow and came back. And it's interesting seeing how many of his friends are in different places. One guy is in Cologne. I think another one is in Canada. I mean, one of my contemporaries is something huge in Black & Decker in the States. Not as in she's a drill, but she's kind of a massive HR manager. And my mum always says that this generation had to move because there was nothing.
I was just wondering, was there a sort of generational exodus from the Northeast? Do you feel like they felt like they lost their youth, the children that they were bringing up because they'd all moved away?
We were all very aspirational. I think the other thing that you could say about this is that miners and people like my father who'd worked in that kind of industry wanted their kids to go on and improve themselves. There was this sort of thing. It wasn't unusual for miners to have, you know, lawyers and doctors as daughters because education was important. And you see that, the social aspect of it, the miners' institutes and even the kind of work they did. Yeah, there were guys cutting coal, but even the guys that cut in coal had to have something about them. And if you were going to be an electrician, you had to be properly trained. If you were going to be the man that drove the pit winder, you had to understand the machinery. So there was a tradition of betterment and improvement. You see that on the railways as well. You know, you start off as a cleaner and you become a fireman or whatever, but even...
And the mutual improvement classes.
Absolutely, mutual improvement classes. That's what I was about to say, yeah. You beat me to it. And steam locomotive engineman's handbook and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, the black book, yeah.
Brilliant, yeah. Yeah, they're really good, aren't they?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we've had a bit of time reading that. Do you think that the end came suddenly? Do you think that it was a shock, or do you think that it had been a long time coming?
I think a lot of people saw the writing on the wall. The decline of the coal industry started in the 1950s and 60s, really, and lots of collieries that had been sunk 100 years ago that were no longer profitable to mine were being closed. There was a guy I knew for a long time, Jackie Brown. Mm-hmm. He'd been a pit fitter in Northumberland, and he'd been on a mechanisation team, and that changed the way in which collieries worked, because a lot of the seams in the northeast were thin, mm-hmm. maybe 2 or 3 feet high, and wet and unpleasant. If you want to get machinery in, you have to build bigger roadways, so it has to be worthwhile to mechanise the collieries. And I think that made a difference. And maybe the sort of experience post Second World War might have had something to do with it. You see a change in social attitudes, don't you, with the teenager and everything else.
Yeah, the advent of teenagers.
Yeah, yeah, it might be part of it.
Before you just got from childhood to adulthood.
Yeah, yeah, it might be part of it. I think my family always saw, my dad knew industry was in decline, and I think he would have counselled if we hadn't have gone the way we went, my brother and I, he would have sort of said, you know, maybe you need to think about this. But there are some legacies of this. If you look at Tyneside, there are lots of hospitals. Why? Because they kind of grow up from the need for people to be treated for injuries. So there's an eye infirmary. There are 2 or 3 big hospitals. And some of them come out of the coal industry and the need to keep their miners. Well, it was often done themselves. It was they need to look after their own. And you still have aged miners' houses. They're called aged miners' homes. They're not for aged miners anymore. But that's what they were set up for, to sort of look after the people after they retired. So there's a whole social seam. And I think we've said before, look at Beamish, because Beamish gives the entire picture. And it shows how the industry permeated everything. And you know, you either worked in the pit, or you worked on the railway, or you worked in the shipyard, and they're all connected.
Well, look at us now. This is ostensibly a railway podcast, but we are talking about the industry that it supported. And I don't think that you can look at the histories of the railways and not look at the interconnectedness of it with politics, with welfare, with communications and social developments and everything else. I think it's all intrinsic to each other.
It's an integrated transport system. Mm-hmm. Effectively, you look at John Bowes and partners. In the 1860s, they owned the collieries, they owned the railway, they owned the discharging points, they set up a shipping company to own the colliers, and they also had part of the shipyard that built the ships. Mm. So that's not one industry, that's three or four.
Mm. Mm. And the power that they must have wielded in the area must have been huge.
Go to Cragside. That was that Armstrong's house up in Northumberland. And you can see the kind of money he must have had. I mean, he had his own hydroelectric power station.
There's also a fact, and I know we're going a bit too far south for you, so sorry about this, but there's a great book called Black Diamonds about the Fitzwilliam family who were in the Elscar Colliery. They were the coal owners of there in Yorkshire. And they built a house bigger than Buckingham Palace with the money they made from coal.
Yeah.
The amounts of money that they're making in those times was insane, that they were just so rich.
Yeah.
You look at that in Social Trends and you can understand why maybe there was backlash against them, saying, why are you keeping all the money when it could be spread around? But, you know, I think they saw themselves as patriarchs. I think they saw themselves as, well, the good coal owners, I think, saw themselves as guardians of their community.
Yeah, and I guess, I think the First World War is probably the catalyst event, isn't it?
Mm. And also you see like a whole generation of the aristocracy being wiped out.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, that is true. Yeah, absolutely.
Should we talk about railways?
Yeah, why not?
Thanks for listening to part one. Please tune in next month for the second half of the episode.